I'm going to try not to panic because my computer is locking up. Well, I know I can at least get started. So I think that's what we're supposed to do. You know, the longest journey begins just with the first step. So that's what we're going to do. A month ago, I was in Detroit, in Detroit, Michigan. And I was there to do the wedding of Chris and Alexis Wilhelm. And it was, again, just a wonderful trip. And while I was there, Mr. Mike Phelps, who's the pastor up there, asked if I'd be willing to do the church service. And so I did, and I thought, what better way to start Chris and Alexis out on their marital journey than to preach at them? And so again, whenever we give a sermon on marriage, there are some scriptures which we most often turn to. They speak of what God intends and the family that he is building, the marital relationship, what it is to be a husband, what it is to be a wife. So when I came home, I thought, you know, I'm gonna give these instructions, this sermon message to the brethren here, but there's part, you know, two. There's the sermon which I gave last month was entitled, Love Her First. Love Her First. And we still don't have we're trying to get the audio copy of that put up from the Colorado Springs congregation, but we had some trouble with the video. But we're working on it. And so, let's see. Aha. We're in luck. So, many of us have heard the phrase, husbands, love your wives. Wives, respect your husbands. So this is part two. And I've entitled this sermon message, Respect, the Key to His Heart. Respect, the Key to His Heart. So I want to begin by covering this in Ephesians. Ephesians 5. In verse 22, Paul is writing to the church in Ephesus, again, to those who are married. And it's interesting, again, because Paul, as far as we know, was not married and never was, and never did get married. And yet he's writing to husbands and wives because he understands the roles, because this is about the mystery of the church, about the Father and his Son, and about us. Ephesians 5, verse 22. He says, Wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord. For the husband is head of the wife, as also Christ is head of the church, and he is the Savior of the body. Therefore, just as the church is subject to Christ, so let wives be to their own husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives. Just as Christ also loved the church, and he gave himself for her, that he might sanctify her and cleanse her with the washing of water by the word, that he might present her to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any of such thing, but that she should be holy and without blemish. So husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes it and cherishes it, just as the Lord does the church. This is what Christ does for all of us, for his bride. He feeds us. He cares for us. He cherishes us. In verse 30, for we are members of his body, of his flesh, of his bones. And for this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. He says, this is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. In verse 33, nevertheless, you know, we understand the great mystery, and this is it on a grand scale of Christ and the church. But here it is to be learned personally in marriage. Nevertheless, let each one of you in particular so love his own wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband. As I said in my first sermon, love her first. The commandment, men, husbands, love your wives, is a commandment. It's not a, you know, well, if you want to, or if she's always happy all the time, you know, if things are always peachy and perfect, well, then, yeah, it's easy to love her. It's not something which we get to choose. Rather, it is something we choose to do. It is a commandment that we are to love. It's not a request. You know, one of the things that we talk about in our world, I'm a big one who, again, likes to preach about love, because this is what you can hang all the commandments on. The love of God and the love of each other. It is vital and it is key. When we talk about the greatest kind of love, what is one of the ways that we often describe the kind of love that everyone wants? Audience participation is okay. What is it we talk about? Maybe, you know, call it godly love. Selfless? Very good. Yeah, Joy? To lay down your life for someone? Yeah. What's another term? Again, and it's not just in the church, but in the world. People talk about what kind of love? Maybe a parent's love. Oh, there it is. Unconditional love. Many times we equate that with agape love, truly godly love. But that is what everyone really wants. Whether you are a man or whether you are a woman, but just as a human being, we want to know that there is unconditional love. But as we look at it, it's not something that we fall into and fall out of. It's something that we're committed to, that I will love, that we choose to do that. When we say our vows in our wedding, That's a statement. I promise to love you. But, you know, as we just read in Ephesians, what we are told is husbands, love your wives. Wives, respect your husbands. Those are equal. How many of you have ever considered maybe the term unconditional respect? What? No. Unconditional respect. That's nuts. You know, I mean, you can lose my respect like that. Bang. I've said this before, and I'm sure I'll say it again. That's not what respect is, brethren. We give respect. You earn trust. See the difference? You can lose trust. You can gain trust. But respect is given. It's not necessarily about the person. It's about the position that they're in. It's about the responsibilities that are placed on them, even if they're kind of horrible. You know, we may not like the person who sits in the office, but do we respect the office? Do we respect the responsibilities that are there? Respect is not something that can be removed when we are unhappy. It is something which must be given, just like the commandment, husbands, love your wives. Wives, respect your husbands. They go hand in hand. And this is the mystery. This is the mystery of the church, as we heard about in the sermonette. Obedience. As Christ has told us, as we've been given His word, to love our wives and to respect our husbands, that is something which we must obey. Again, our world doesn't understand that. That's why Paul refers to it as a mystery. Because in our world, that's nuts. That doesn't make any sense at all. But that is what God says. You know, when we look at husbands and wives, at marriage, at relationships, you know what we want? We want romance. Right? Brethren, do you know what this is? It's the greatest romance story ever written. From the beginning to the end, it is about love. It is the love of the father who wants a bride for his son. That he not be alone, that they have a family. That they want children to come from it, to grow. He wants those children to be like him. He has a son who is willing to die for his bride. You know, again, they write romance novels about this kind of stuff all the time. It's what the heart longs for. Brethren, in this book, you know, if you want to look at romance novels, this has everything. It's got everything in it. I mean, there's passion, there's desire, there's love, there's intrigue. It's an epic story. There's the rise and fall of nations, life and death. And ultimately, this epic romance is concluded with a wedding. A long-awaited and dearly fought for and striven for marriage between Christ and His bride, whom He literally laid down His life for. It's the greatest romance ever written. Do we know what it's not? A fairy tale. It is not Disney. It's not made up. It's not make-believe. You don't necessarily see the everybody lives happily ever after. Cinderella doesn't ride away with a handsome prince and birds singing. It's real. Real people, real stories. It is life. Ladies, those of you who are married, how many of you are living the dream? How many of you, is it a fairy tale? You know, when you wake up in the morning, everything is perfect and beautiful, and the sun is shining in your window, and you open the shutters and break into song. Little birds gather along the sill and chirp along with you. That's a fairy tale. And it's sweet, and we enjoy it, and it touches our hearts. But it's not real. You know, my beautiful bride wakes up in the morning and stretches and gets ready, and she gets up and walks and probably trips over my boots that I left on the floor and picks up my dirty underwear and throws them away, and she's like, ah. That's real. That is life. And it's not a fairy tale. It's funny because that is what so many of us want, because we kind of grew up on it, right? How many of you grew up on Disney? You know, all the fairy tales and the romance of it, and, you know, and the knight in shining armor who can sing too. You know, talk about a unicorn. I mean, it's like, not too many of those exist. Because it isn't real, brethren. The real romance, the greatest romance, it's not a fairy tale. You know what it is, though? It's messy. It's messy because people are messy. In the greatest romance ever written, there is heartbreak. There is betrayal. There are broken vows and deep, deep hurts. But there's also highs. There is love and sacrifice, honor and respect and integrity. Those are real. Those are real. And it's that kind of messy stuff that Hollywood doesn't like to portray, that Disney doesn't want to show us. But again, this is part of the mystery. Part of the mystery is that we have a Savior. We have a bridegroom who, knowing all of our faults, all of our brokenness and our mess, is still willing to lay down his life for you, for me, for all of us. That's that unconditional love that we crave. And we know that it's not the unconditional love of the world, that it is true agape love. We want our prince to come, our king, and lift us out of our faults and sins, out of the ditch. And all those times when we fell short and we didn't live up to our covenant, we still want to know that he loves us. Brethren, I want to look today at a woman of God, a woman who made a choice to respect her husband and do good to him. And it's not a fairy tale. It's not. She was in a really tough, very difficult position where, you know, if we look at our own carnal natures and the way of the world, we think, this lady's nuts. She's nuts. But she's willing to live by the word of God, even when it wasn't easy and when it wasn't good. And in the end, God blesses her for it with her life. But her marriage still doesn't become a fairy tale. Not the way the world would look at it, or the way that maybe we would want. But her choice to respect her husband and all of her actions that then followed promise that in her next marriage, her last marriage as the bride of Christ, she will truly rejoice. This is about unconditional respect. If you would, turn with me to 1 Samuel. First Samuel. Some of you may already know where I'm going with this. I want to talk about a woman named Abigail. Abigail is a story which some know. Many of our ladies will look to as an example. Abigail by name was Her name means her father's joy. And I think it is fitting. But before we can really tell you about Abigail, we have to tell you about the situation that she finds herself in. This is the time during which David is on the run from King Saul. And things are bad. Things are really bad. And she is married to a man named Nabal. We'll begin in 1 Samuel 25 and verse 1. This is shortly after, Samuel. It says, Samuel died, and the Israelites gathered together and lamented for him, and buried him at his home in Ramah. And David arose and went down to the wilderness of Paran. In verse 2, now there was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel. And the man was very rich. He had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats, and he was shearing his sheep in Carmel. And the name of the man was Nabal, and the name of his wife, Abigail. And she was a woman of good understanding and beautiful appearance. But the man was harsh and evil in all his doings. He was of the house of Caleb. So remember Caleb. Joshua and Caleb were the two spies who went into the promised land and brought back the good report, who was willing to conquer the land for his own inheritance, who was of a different spirit that God honored. I don't know how many generations after it is, but even his household fell. His grandson or great-grandson, I don't know which, was not a wise man. In verse 4, when David heard in the wilderness that Nabal was shearing his sheep, David sent 10 young men, and David said to the young men, go up to Carmel, go to Nabal, and greet him in my name. And thus you shall say to him who lives in prosperity, because he was filthy rich, peace be to you, peace to your house, and peace to all that you have. Now I have heard that you have shearers. Your shepherds were with us, and we did not hurt them. Remember, they're out in the wilderness. They had their flocks out there as David and his men were hiding from Saul. And he says, we did not hurt them, nor was there anything missing from them while they were in Carmel. And right here you have a band of men, warriors. It takes a lot to take care of that many people. They need food. They need sustenance. And they didn't take anything from them. In fact, they also protected them in the wilderness. In verse 8, he says, ask your young men, and they will tell you. Therefore, let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we come on a feast day. Please, give whatever comes to your hand to your servants and to your son David. This is asking, give us what you will, something. He doesn't say, provide a feast for us. He's just saying, we need help. We need assistance. In verse 9, so when David's young men came, they spoke to Nabal, saying all these words in the name of David, and they waited. And Nabal answered David's servants and said, who is David? And who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants nowadays who break away, each one from his master. Shall I take my bread and my water and my meat that I have killed for my shearers and give it to men who I do not know from where they come? Yeah, that's not true. Everybody knew who David was. Remember, he was that boy who went out and faced the enemy of Israel, Goliath, and slew him. The whole nation sang songs about him. You know, Saul has killed his thousands, David his tens of thousands. They knew him. They knew who he was, but they also knew that he was out of favor with Saul. And Nabal shames him. In verse 12, so David's young men turned on their heels and went back, and they came and told David all these words. And verse 13, then David said to his men, get your swords, boys. We're going riding. I paraphrased that a little bit, made him a little more cowboy. But he says, every man gird on his sword. And so every man girded on his sword, and David also girded on his sword. And about 400 men went with David, and 200 stayed with the supplies. Now one of the young men told Abigail, this is, now we're back in Nabal's property. He goes to Abigail, Nabal's wife, saying, look, David sent messengers from the wilderness greeting our master, and he reviled them. This wasn't just a, no, sorry, I don't have anything to spare. He reviled them. But when the men, and he says, but the men were very good to us, and we were not hurt, nor did we miss anything as long as we accompanied them when we were in the fields. He's like, they protected us in the wilderness. And he says, they were a wall to both, or to us both by night and day. They guarded us all the time we were with them, keeping the sheep. Now, therefore, know and consider what you will do, for harm is determined to fall against our master and against all his household. For he is such a scoundrel that one cannot speak to him. In verse 18, we begin to see the character of this woman. Then Abigail made haste and took 200 loaves of bread, 2 skins of wine, 5 sheep already dressed, 5 seahs of roasted grain, and 100 clusters of raisins, 200 cakes of figs, and loaded them on donkeys. Remember, David was saying, you know, if you got something left, just anything, some food, some grain, some bread. She's not only giving them grain and bread, but wine and sheep and meat and dessert. That's what she's packing for them. These 100 cakes of figs. In verse 19, and she said to her servants, go on before me. See, I am coming after you. But she did not tell her husband, Nabal. What do you think would have happened if she had? No. No, he was determined. He had set his course. In verse 20, so it was she rode on the donkey, and she went down under the cover of the hill. And there was David and his men coming down toward her, and she met them. Verse 21, now David had said, surely in vain I have protected all that this fellow has in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed of all that belongs to him. And he has repaid me evil for good. May God do so and more also to the enemies of David, for if I leave one male of all who belong to him by morning light. Remember that title which God gave him as a man of blood? It's true. If his blood was raised, if he was riled, look out. In verse 23, now when Abigail saw David, she dismounted quickly from the donkey, fell on her face before David, and bowed down to the ground. So she fell at his feet and said, on me, my Lord, on me, let this iniquity be. And please, let your maidservant speak in your ears and hear the words of your maidservant. Please, let not my Lord regard this scoundrel Nabal. For as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name. That means literally fool. That's his name. You know, I don't know who gave that to him, but I would suspect it came from his family. And she says, and folly is with him. But I, your maidservant, did not see the young men of my Lord whom you sent. She's like, I would have handled this differently. I am so sorry. One of the things which I very much appreciate here, reading the commentaries, Matthew Henry expresses this, because we look at it and goes, well, how is she respecting her husband? How does that fit? Because she said, well, his name is Nabal, which means fool. She knows why David has come and what he plans to do. Matthew Henry explains it this way. She excuses her husband's fault by imputing it to his natural weakness and want of understanding. She says, let not my Lord take notice of his rudeness and ill manners, for it is just like him. It is not the first time that he has behaved so churlishly. He must be born with, for it was for want of wit. Nabal is his name, again, which signifies fool or boor or dim. And folly is with him. It was owning to his folly, not his malice. He is simple, but not spiteful. Forgive him, for he knows not what he does. Again, this is Matthew Henry's paraphrase. What she said was true, and she said it to excuse his fault and prevent his ruin. Else she would not have done well to give such a bad character as this of her own husband, whom she ought to make the best of and not speak ill of. So even in doing this, she's trying to save her husband. And she's like, it's just who he is. He doesn't understand. He has no concept of it. He's not very bright. You know, if he were smart, he would not have offended a guy with 600 warriors. You got to let this one slide. Verse 26, she says, now therefore, my Lord. Again, how many times has she called him my Lord? How many times has she said, your maidservant? Who's she married to? Nabal, descendant of Caleb. She's rich. She is rich. And here she is bowing down to a man who's on the run for his life. He's an outlaw. And she is calling him Lord. And she is submitting herself to him, humbling herself before him. Something she does not truly have to do. 26, now therefore, my Lord, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, since the Lord has held you back from coming to bloodshed and from avenging yourself with your own hand, now then let your enemies and those who seek harm from my Lord be as Nabal. Let them come to nothing and be foolish. Verse 27, and now this present which your maidservant has brought to my Lord, let it be given to the young men who follow you, who follow my Lord. Please forgive the trespass of your maidservant. Was she the one that gave the offense? No. But look at the honor and even the shame. She's giving her husband honor and accepting the shame herself. For the Lord will certainly make for my Lord an enduring house, because my Lord, again speaking of David, fights the battles of the Lord, and evil is not found in you throughout your days. She's praising David, building up again the guy who's on the outs. Verse 29, yet a man has risen to pursue you and seek your life, but the life of my Lord shall be bound in the bundle of the living with the Lord, your God. And the lives of your enemies he shall sling out as from the pocket of a sling. I think she's reminding him where he came from, how God delivered him when he was young. And it shall come to pass when the Lord has done for my Lord according to all the good that he has spoken concerning you and has appointed you ruler over Israel, that this will be no grief to you. She's like, this thing that you are offended by, that you are so angry about, and you are coming to exact more than your pound of flesh. Don't let this be on you. Don't let this scar or smear what it is that God is going to do for you. That this will be no grief to you, nor offense of your heart to my Lord, either that you have shed blood without cause or that my Lord has avenged himself. And when the Lord has dealt well with my Lord, then remember your maidservant. She's saying, remember, whatever comes, whatever happens, you're going to be king. Remember that I have submitted myself to you, that I have intervened, that I have done you good. And when you're king, don't exact punishment or revenge. How impressed do you think David was seeing this woman, who actually stopped him from hurting himself? Because that's what he would have done. I mean, you know, we just sang a song about don't worry what you shall wear or what you shall eat. And David's offended. And he's like, that's it. You and me. Here we go. And it would have plagued him. And she saves him, in a sense, from himself, just as she is saving Nabal from himself. In verse 32, then David said to Abigail, blessed is the Lord God of Israel who sent you this day to meet me. You have been a blessing to me. And blessed is your advice. And blessed are you. You know, she didn't come to him haughty and proud. You know, like she could have. She could have shown up in the carriage and all the gold and wealth and, here you go. Sorry, please excuse us. Ha, ha, ha. She doesn't. She doesn't do that at all. All she does is pour out respect, not only to him, but to her husband, in covering him. Blessed is your advice, and blessed are you, because you have kept me this day from coming to bloodshed and avenging myself with my own hand. For indeed, as the Lord God of Israel lives, who has kept me back from hurting you, unless you had hurried and come to meet me, surely by morning light, no males would have been left to Nabal. Like, if you hadn't stopped me, oh, this would have been bad. So David received from her hand what she had brought him and said to her, go up in peace to your house. See, I have heeded your voice and respected your person. He's like, I'm going to forgive this. And there's an honor here. I am taking your word to heart. And it is a blessing for me and for you. And you are being returned safe and sound. Can you imagine how scary that must have been? You know, the tension of it. The anxiety. You know what could have been said when things are heated, when passions are flared? And the words which she spoke, I believe, again, inspired by God, but led by her heart, by her character. What if she would have come and said something different? My husband's an idiot, but spare me. Would that have been tempting? Of course it would have. Hey, I didn't do it. If I'd have been there, I'd have given you plenty. It's not my fault. Don't take it out on us. He's the moron. Human nature. But that's not what God has told us to do. I mean, she was respecting her husband because she chose to. She chose to obey God and the responsibility and the position which God has given to her. In verse 36, now Abigail went to Nabal, and there he was holding a feast in his house, like the feast of a king. You know, they finished shearing. They had all the wool that had come in. Not only is he rich, but he's just gotten richer. And he's throwing a party for himself. Woohoo! there is so much wine flowing, so much excess. Imagine the feast of a king. He is just lavishly throwing this. I mean, can you imagine even just the vessels that he was pouring the wine out of? And Nabal's heart was merry within him, for he was very drunk. Imagine he wasn't looking very kingly. Imagine what that must have done to her heart. Seeing her husband, probably, you know, I think of, you know, the drunken guy, you know, putting the crown on his head and yet falling in his own vomit. How hard would it be for her to respect him in that moment? Think she wanted to shut it off? Treat him differently? Yeah. But that's not who Abigail is. Therefore, she told him nothing, little or much, until morning light. She's like, this is not going to make any difference. This is not going to help or hinder. I'll wait. It also tells us something about how little love Nabal had for his wife. How long did it take her to go and travel to meet David? Nabal didn't even notice she was gone. You know, he certainly was not feeling his responsibility to love his wife. It was horrible. She fulfilled her responsibility in spite of him. Verse 37, so it was in the morning when the wine had finally gone from Nabal that his wife told him these things. It doesn't say that she, you know, came and told him, you're an idiot, you're this, you're that, you owe me, I saved you. She just went and told him. I believe, and most of the commentaries believe, that she told him how close he came to dying. That David was on their doorstep. Remember, he knew who David was. And it says his heart died within him and he became like a stone. Many believe that this is he either had a heart attack or a stroke. He realized just how close he came to destruction. In verse 38, then it happened after about 10 days that the Lord struck Nabal and he died. For 10 days he laid there in his bed. In verse 39, so when David heard that Nabal was dead, like, what? He said, blessed be the Lord, who has pleaded the cause of my reproach from the hand of Nabal and has kept his servant from evil. He knows that God acted through Abigail and kept him from doing evil, from sinning, from doing wrong, committing murder. The Bible doesn't say that David was justified. He was mad. He was disrespected and offended. And he was going with the sword. The Bible doesn't say that's an excuse. God prevented him from doing that, and he used Abigail to do it through her heart, through her attitude. For the Lord has returned the wickedness of Nabal on his own head. Nobody else died. All the servants, all the men who were spared. And then David sent and proposed to Abigail that he take her as his wife. How impressed was David by this woman? You know, most kings did not marry for love. Rulers throughout history, they married for an advantage. Sometimes it was land, sometimes it was wealth, sometimes it was to end wars, sometimes it was to make treaties, to bring in allies. Something that strengthened your position. David sees this woman as a strength to him. He just saw her divert a catastrophe. You know, something which would have been horrible. A day that would have lived in infamy. And he says, this woman would be an excellent wife to me. Verse 40, and when the servants of David had come to Abigail at Carmel, they spoke to her saying, David sent us to you to ask that you become his wife. Ladies, is this how you want to be proposed to? And we talk about people who break up over text messages. You know, I remember when I was a kid, we didn't have cell phones. You sent your friend, you know. And whether it was to find out if they liked you or not, you know, or whether it was to break up, you know. David sends his servants to ask Abigail. In verse 41, and then she arose and bowed her face to the earth. Again, I believe Abigail knows how close catastrophe was and that it was God who spared her. And it was because of her obedience. She chose to respect and honor not only her husband, but the future king. When she was in a position where nobody would have blamed her for being disrespectful. I mean, I would look at it and be like, yeah. But that's not what God expects. That's not what he expects from any of us. And here she is, having received this, and again she bows her face to the earth and says, here is your maidservant. Again, can you imagine some of the rich celebrities doing something like that? You know, in our society today, it's all about pride. Lift your head and haughty. She has the exact opposite. She says, here is your maidservant, a servant to wash the feet of the servants of my Lord. She's offering to wash their feet. In verse 42, so Abigail rose in haste and rode on a donkey, attended by five of her maidens, and she followed the messengers of David and became his wife. You know, this also says something about Abigail. Was David rich? Nope. He was living in caves, hiding from Saul, begging for food. He was not king. There were some who wanted him to be, some who kind of believed that he'd been anointed to be king, but he wasn't. She also saw character in him. She saw something in him that she honored and respected. And it's funny because even in this, it's not a fairy tale. It's still not the fairy tale. You know, what would the fairy tale be? What would that look like? And so she rides to him and he falls madly and deeply in love with her. And they become one. And he eventually defeats the evil king Saul, and then they become king and queen, and they rule together in peace and harmony, and you can see the rainbows and the birds and hear the song. That's Disney. And that's what we all want, right? Again, how many of you are living the fairy tale? The reality is that David also took Ahinoam of Jezreel, and so they both were his wives. That would not have gone over in my marriage. Just saying. Again, that goes away from the idea of the fairy tale. This is the reality. And it was messy. It was going to be messy. Do you think she had to live in a cave with him?
Yeah.
In fact, we know she did. Because later on, while he was out fighting the Philistines, others came and raided the camp. And she and Ahinoam were captured and taken away. And David had to come back and save her. This was not easy. Not the fairy tale. The fairy tale would have been a lot closer if she just stayed where she was at, in the house of Caleb, remarried there, kept all that wealth, all that luxury, because, you know, he's dead now. I don't have to put up with him anymore. You know, so often we want the fairy tale. That's what we want. That's our desire. But the reality is very different. However, I believe, and I wanted to use Abigail as an example for this, because she is a woman who, in spite of everything around her, chose to obey the Lord. Her first marriage was not the fairy tale. Even her marriage to the king of Israel, I would dare say, not the fairy tale. What about her third marriage? There is another marriage coming for every woman and every man. It is the marriage of the bride, the king that will return, who is sinless, who will establish a kingdom of peace. That is going to be that final marriage, and we will never be separated from him. The choice to honor the commandment to respect her husband, your husband, our husband, is ultimately for that marriage. The one we have today is so we learn the lesson. It's unconditional. And it is by choice. Do you know why? Because there is no other choice. Just like husbands love your wives, it's not conditional. Do it. Respect is just the same, because it's the commandment of God. Off the top of my head, I can't think of a single other better example than Abigail. Her fairy tale is going to come. But she set the example today. She did her husband, I believe both of them, good all of her days and not evil. I think she's a wonderful example of Proverbs 31. All those different examples, again, not one woman, but pictures of a multitude of women. Brethren, I want to look at this and see how, just as I talked to the men, to husbands, to love your wives and tried to give tips on how to do it, points that we need to focus on if we are going to fulfill that commandment, so that our wives know that they are loved, so that it's active. It's very easy to say, I love you, and not live it, not show it. Abigail could have said, I respect you. She showed it. This is what we have to do. So, point number one on respect, on wives, this is, again, to the heart of your husband. This is why God has given this to us and why it is a mystery about the church and about the responsibilities and the positions which God has given to us, how he made us. Point number one is men thrive on respect. Men thrive on respect. And the last time I talked about a woman's heart and how much she longs to be loved. Longs to be loved, to be adored. And it starts from her earliest years as a little girl. She wants her father to look at her and see her as precious. To, you know, I told the story of my girls coming out and showing me their Sabbath dress and twirling. And their eyes would look at their dress and see how pretty it was, but then they'd look at me to see if I was watching and if I was captivated by them. That never changes. Again, from the young man who picks her up for a dance or a date or the prom, or when she walks down the aisle on her wedding day, she wants to see that look on her husband's face, that he is, you know, intoxicated by her, that he adores her, that he is stunned by her. All those things, ladies, that when you think of how much your heart longs to be loved like that, I want you to think about that. And now understand that that is the way that your husband needs to be respected. That feeling in your heart that says, I want him to love me and cherish me. It's the same feeling in your husband's heart for you to honor and respect him. Doesn't go away. It's the same. And we don't, you know, it starts as little boys. And we don't grow out of it. You know, we have a lot of little boys in our congregations. I have my own little boy. Some of you have boys. Have you ever seen a little boy show something to his mom and like pick up a chair? And he's like, Mama, look at my muscles. And I'll try to flex. What's he want mom to do? Oh my, look how strong you are. Wow, you lifted that all by yourself. Wow, you are so strong. You're going to be such a big, strong boy. And he's like, Mama, you want me to lift something else? He thrives on that. Guess what? Just like the little girl, we don't grow out of that either. Years ago, Joy and I were in Montana, and a friend of hers had come over. Sarah was really little, and she had her little kids, and they were playing. And she went to back out of our driveway, and she cut a little too quickly, and one of her front tires went off the culvert into the ditch and tipped like this. And there was no traction for the tires to go. It was just tipped up. Back end was kind of up in the air. And because of this deep irrigation ditch, I couldn't get my truck back there. I was like, you know, if I could just get behind her and hook on, I could easily pull them out. But I got nothing. So I started looking at it, and I was like, you know, I think I might be able to get down in the ditch. And I think I can lift it up enough that if it can get traction, at least on one side, that it'll pull itself out. And I was like, okay, we're gonna try this. I said, you get in the car and give it some gas. Keep your foot on the brake, so don't come forward. And I was a little nervous about that. And so Joy's out there, and they're like, oh no, we're gonna have to call a tow. And I was like, we'll just wait. Give me a minute. So I crawled underneath there, and it was really at the perfect angle that I could get myself wedged underneath the front bumper and using my legs and my back just and lift. It was spectacular. The rear end went down, lifted the front end, and she, you know, her tires caught, and she was able to back out. And, of course, I went, have a nice day. It was funny because she was so shocked. I mean, I remember lifting and looking up, and the lady who was in the van, her face was like, oh. And then, you know, she backed up. She's like, wow, thank you. That was awesome. Thank you. And I was like, yeah, it's okay. Save the day. It's what I do. And I turn around, and Joy was looking at me. She's like, oh. And I was like, hey, babe. She's like, I can't believe you did that. I was like, did what? She's like, you lifted that whole car. Okay, now I know I didn't. I know leverage and all of that. But I was like, hey, sweetie, you need anything else picked up around here? More than willing to help out there, you know. Brethren, that never goes away. To this day, if my wife leans over to me, I'm like, see, you still got it, hun. Men thrive on respect. We are given to be the stronger vessel. As I used to tell Joy, I'm not smart, but I can lift heavy things. When we recognize that, when we honor that, it builds your husband up. When you say those things which are so easily taken for granted, thank you for working, for providing, for coming home, for doing these things which, yeah, that's my job, it's what I'm supposed to do. But when we recognize it, you become your husband's helpmate. You may not be able to crawl down in the ditch with him or go to work with him, but when you build him up, you also build up yourself. And it's amazing the desire the husband has to love and care for and protect his bride when she does that for him. Point number one is men thrive on respect. Point number two. Respect has a tone. Respect has a tone. It is one that we can hear and usually we can see. This is something that we as men, we hear. I know years ago, a buddy of mine, I'll call him one of my Philistine friends. he was talking about it, and he's like, women hear like 13 different tones, and he's like, guys, we hear like three. You know, it's, oh, she's angry. Oh, she's happy. And maybe one was other, different. He was a Philistine. And he was like, but I also think one of the ones that we really hear is disrespect. Because we can pick up on that with men. You can tell when men are talking, and even if nothing is said wrong, you look at the guy and you're like, excuse me? I do this with my kids. You know, I'm like, son, I want you to go do this. I'm like, excuse me? It's funny because women have many different tones. And women do tend to be more verbal than men. And we're not going to hear a whole lot of them. I mean, there's things she's like, I can't believe he didn't do that. I mean, I said this one thing and I can't believe he didn't get it. And we're like, didn't pick it up on that at all. But the respect tone, we hear. Because it's where we live with other men. This is how we're programmed and designed. We pick up on it very, very quickly. Tone, body language, says a multitude of words. You may think, what? I said okay. I agreed. But what did your tone say? How was Abigail's tone? I don't think she tried to sneak that in there and let him know what she really thought of him. Yeah, I'm going to say this because I have to do it, but eh. She doesn't do that. Not once, not at all. Do you think that if she had, David would have asked her to be his bride, to be his wife? That's one thing that men will pick up on. If she's disrespectful to someone else, to maybe her father, she's going to be disrespectful to me. And guess what a guy will do? Oh, no, 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 no. This is what we as men do. This is important to remember. Point number three. And this is something that I believe has been going on since Adam and Eve were kicked out of the garden. And something which Satan actively works to instill and promote and aggravate. Point number three is the battle of the sexes has no winners. The battle of the sexes has no winners. What we see happening in our society today, what we see happening, do you see anybody who's actually happy or content? Men are being ridiculed and mocked continually. You know, if there's one thing that we can do is tear down the head of the family. You know, that evil patriarchy. It's a part of the whole woke movement, which our government seems to really be attuned to. It's being taught in all of our schools. It's being taught to our children, and frankly, we're catching it too. This is part of the mystery of the church. If the bride, if the body of Christ is in conflict with itself, if the arm is, you know, upset about the leg, well, I want to do what the leg does. Well, I want to do what the arm does. It won't work. Because that's not how we're made. This is how God made us. These are the responsibilities that God has laid out. As we look at Ephesians 5, these are our roles. And you can't fight that. If we do, we all lose. That's just the way it works. God has made us with individual strengths, individual abilities, and they're awesome. They are beautiful. They are a blessing. And when we come together and we fit, we are to become one. We complement each other. That's what that word actually means, you know, to be a helpmate. Comparable to Him. Not the same, not identical, but comparable. This is how we grow and produce good fruit. When we contend with one another, that all stops. And then the helpmate, as the Bible says, that word is strong ally. Then we stop being an ally. Men tend to look at respect like David and Nabal. Nabal completely disrespected David, right? What was David going to do? Guess what? That's what men do. That is what we do. Regardless of our size or our stature, that's what we want to do. You know, it's one of the reasons why we like, you know, these kind of, you know, action movies. You know, Dirty Harry. Oh, really? You feel lucky? That's inside every man. Oh, you're going to disrespect me? I mean, David was coming as a man. He'd forgotten to be a man of God. But this is how he's made biologically. Look at the natural world. You get a couple of bulls together, what are they going to do? They're going to figure out who's top. You know, you get a bull with a herd, and another bull comes in, what are they going to do? This is how they're made. Lions and bulls, deer, stallions. That is inherent in each and every man. It's how God made us. Now, what happens in our society as we see the push that women are to be men and you're allowed to dominate them? How many of you have seen like clips on the news or YouTube where a woman physically gets in a man's face? And what does he have to do? Can't hit her, can't hit her, can't hit her. And then she walks away like, huh, showed him. That is a hollow victory. She's just defeating herself. He's not allowed, you're stepping into a man's world, but he's not allowed to treat you like a man. He's not allowed to do what God made him to do. Whose fault is that? It's hers. The battle of the sexes is not a fair fight. It's a trap. Nobody's going to win if we do that. God made us different. If a woman does that, if she belittles him, if she gets in his face, if she is contentious with him, you know what he will immediately do? He will stop loving you like dropping a hot rock. And then you both lose. We lose. It's so hard to come back from those things. And yet that is what our society is pushing continually. It's in all the movies. You know, Marvel and Disney. There's some little 115-pound girl beating up 250-pound guys, knocking them out. And we're telling our kids, yeah, you go, girl. It's not true. That's a fairy tale. The battle of the sexes makes everyone lose. Whether it's a man who thinks that he can take advantage of women and do all these things, it's empty and hollow. He doesn't get to have what God intended for him to have, to grow and be fulfilled, to have a helpmate, to actually have a strong ally who he can actually share his fears with, his heart with. I think that's why Eve was made from Adam's rib. Our ribs protect our vitals, our heart. If a man doesn't have that, he is weakened. If a woman tries to take over the role of the man, she weakens herself. It is a trap. Instead, we can choose to build him up. Abigail, even when her husband was not fulfilling his role, his responsibility, what did she do? She still went to defend him, to save him, to even honor the position that he was in. Not because he was honorable, but because that was the position he was in. That is unconditional respect. And it is a blessing. Proverbs 12, verse 7 says, an excellent wife is the crown of her husband. Where do you wear a crown? On your head. It's seen. It is there for all the world to see. And it's beautiful. It is a sign of nobility. That is what happens when a husband feels respected. He is proud of his wife. He honors her and gives her a place of prominence. Brethren, as I finished out my sermon on love her first, the last tip or point that I could give anyone was re-involve God in your marriage. This is for men and women. This is that we have to pray together. Again, this covenant that we have is between the two of us and God. He is that third string of that threefold cord. And he has promised, as we have heard, that wherever two or more are gathered, I will be there. That entire passage is not about church. It's about conflict within the body. Wherever we are, it's within our marriage. If we are dealing with conflict, whether that's between us or conflict that we are facing from the outside, God says he'll be there and he will help us overcome it. He will help us endure. He will bring us together and bind us and strengthen us. This is, again, the blessing of what God has given, because this is what he wants as a family. He wants us to understand love and respect. Brethren, God instituted the covenant of marriage, which is why he calls it holy matrimony. Holy matrimony. And it is for our good. It always has been. And he longs to pour out his blessings upon us. You know what that's going to take? Two things, and they're just like the two great commandments that support all the others. Because there's a lot more to it. It's a lot more complicated than just love and respect. But that's where it starts. And on that hang all the other aspects and issues of marriage and of the mystery of the church. Husbands, love your wives. Wives, respect your husbands. 1 Peter 3 and verse 8 says this: finally, all of you be of one mind. This is the church, the body, and this is us as couples, as those who are married, having compassion for one another. Love as brothers. Be tender-hearted. Be courteous. Not returning evil for evil or reviling for reviling. We don't get to shut it off because someone's having a bad day, whether that's love or respect. But on the contrary, blessing, knowing that you were called to this and that you may inherit a blessing.